Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
From River North, it's John Williams live on 720 WGN. Live from Saturday Night Live and the SNL exhibit at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Now, welcome, John Williams.
Chris Duffy, you've got it down. Well done. Thank you. 108 on WGN Radio. We are now live from our Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Today's show is live from, well, it's almost impossible not to suddenly cop that voice, live from Saturday Night Live, the experience at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. It's good to be here. We'll be here until 3 o'clock. Violetta Podramedic is here. We have a nice little crowd of folks who won tickets from us on WGN Radio. Steve Bertrand's walking across the way, and we have a couple of guests that will pop in either in studio or on the phone. Our guest Mark will be joining us in just a minute. Mark Locke, who is the creative director of this exhibit, SNL The Experience. And we're going to talk a lot about that on the show today and then sort of divert off to a couple of other topics, including, I'll just say this now because it deserves to be said at the top of the show, and then I'll say a few things at greater length after our 1:30 break and WGN Radio News. And that is Milt Rosenberg, the longtime host of Extension 720 here on WGN Radio, passed away yesterday. I know a lot of you that are here watching us right now in this Museum of Broadcast Communications remember him and loved him. He was iconic in Chicago. I didn't understand what he was talking about half the time, but I knew it was really good when he was doing it, and that was enough for me. I knew I didn't always have to know what he was talking about. The guy was a maestro at his craft, and that was enough. So we'll give him his due. Maybe it's almost important or appropriate that we are at a place that honors great broadcasting today, because Milt was surely a great broadcaster. You know, we're also going to sort of recollect since we're here. So here's what you have. On State Street, downtown Chicago, not too far from, oh, I don't know, the Corncob Towers, the Trump Tower, the River, Harry Carey's. That's the little neighborhood we're in, Violetta. There's this building called the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Mm-hmm. Have you toured here before?
I have not, but I think everyone who goes to the corner of State and Kinsey have seen that Christmas tree almost of the TVs or radios and are like, what is
that? Oh, that's right.
That?
Yeah. It's really cool. This is where we are. We're on the fourth floor right now, and they have an installation here called the Saturday Night Live Experience. And it's really fun. It is really well done. You know how sometimes you go somewhere and you go, oh, yeah, it's a couple of T-shirts and a couple of posters. That wasn't the SNL experience. This is. You'll sit in seats just the way people do that are in the audience for the opening monologue and act. And then to your immediate right when you're sitting there, you actually are as close as is humanly possible to the set where Alex Trebek is doing Celebrity Jeopardy. And that's the actual board and the actual podiums that, you know, Burt Reynolds or Sean Connery would be doing their shtick. So it's up close and personal. On the one hand, you get impressed with the sort of magic and grandeur of it all, but you also realize, wow, it's tiny. It's not as fancy as I thought it was going to be.
It's cozy.
It is. Well, there you go. That's what it is. It's not small or tiny. It's cozy. Mark Locke curated this for the museum, and he's not here today, but he's on a phone. Hey, Mark, you're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I am well, John. Pleasure to be with you. How are you?
Nice job. We're doing well. This is a hit. We're glad that you were able to do what you did, Mark.
Well, a labor of love, I guess. You know, the opportunity started many, many years ago when, of all things, I met Lorne Michaels in our King Tut exhibition. The same way, this was in New York, but the same one that was at the Field Museum. The conversation started then, and it didn't happen back then, 2010. But when the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live came around a couple years ago, which we may all remember from the special, it seemed like anybody everybody who was anybody was at that special, and the 40th anniversary season, and to celebrate this thing came about, and we were able to open in New York and now take it on the road for the first time to Chicago.
Yeah. So you curate things. Is that it? You did the Titanic exhibit. You did the King Tut exhibit at the Field, and you were also responsible for imagining and putting this thing together here, huh?
Yeah, I'm not complaining. it's been quite a run for me doing things that I really love, and certainly the city of Chicago has been quite kind to both of those other exhibitions you mentioned. We did the Titanic exhibition back in 2000. And then in 2002 at the Museum of Science and Industry, and then the Tutankhamun exhibition at the Field Museum. And when we were looking to take the Saturday Night Live exhibition on the road, it seemed like the natural choice not only to go to Chicago because of its incredible connections to Saturday Night Live over the years with Second City and Improv Olympics, but also that museum that you've just talked about, kind of the perfect fit as far as its mission and space. I mean, you're on the fourth floor now, as you mentioned, John, but the exhibition actually starts on the second floor, as you know, and takes you through the week of putting Saturday Night Live together. So you're right. I've had the privilege, the opportunity, and the pure fun of sitting there at 30 Rock and watching the rehearsals and the writing sessions and the read-throughs and going out to the scenic shop out in Brooklyn and watching it all come together in the matter of 6 days. You know, they start with kind of a clean slate every week. And one of my favorite quotes in the exhibition from Lorne Michaels is, we don't start because we're ready. We start because it's 11:30. So it's this kind of high-wire act every week, and we hope that this exhibition takes people behind the scenes like never before.
I thought it'd be enough just to say, give me the set, we'll stick it in the corner, folks will marvel at it. But to do this, you immerse yourself in it? You actually hung around Saturday Night Live for a while?
Yes. One of the joys of the job that I do, you know, when we did the Titanic exhibit, I was able to get in one of those small submersibles and go to the bottom of the ocean and see the Titanic firsthand. When we did the Tut exhibit, going to King Tut's tomb in Egypt. But, you know, all those are pretty spectacular emotional experiences. But, you know, it was always on my bucket list to at least see Saturday Night Live. You know, with all due respect to Hamilton, it's the toughest ticket in town in New York. I mean, you can't buy a ticket to SNL. There are about 20, 21 shows a season. And for me, not only to see the show, but kind of spend the season there watching it all happen, they gave me full access and also participated. You know, I want to give credit where credit is due. The scenic department, the hair and makeup, the wardrobe department, the writers, the cast, during rehearsals, they kind of all participated in putting this together. And I've had a small part in that as well, of course. But I think when you see this exhibition and you see the love and care that went into presenting it, you see all those folks that bring the show every week to life also helped to bring this exhibition to life.
Violetta and I and Steve Bertrand and Elif were all talking, the team here, about, okay, so what are some of your favorite Saturday Night Live skits or bits? Yours is...
All things Sarah Palin.
Yeah, that was good.
Very good.
She can see Russia.
You know, and when I, how can you argue, like, this is an argument no one can win, because you say, okay, I'll say TFA doing Sarah Palin, but then I'll counter with Sweaty Balls, you know, that skit.
And that's always a good one.
And so I don't know how you pick amongst your children, which do you like the best? You know, the one that I was kind of thinking of, though, that if you go down that road is Landshark. Do you remember Landshark? What a stupid bit. How was that so resonant and memorable and funny? I mean, okay, here's just a clip from Landshark circa, what would you guess the year is I'm going to play here, Mark? 1970s, late 70s maybe?
75. I think that was during the first season. And when you, after you play the clip, I'll give you a little info about how it connects to the exhibition as well.
How about that? Here we go.
Who is it?
This is Robin Lopez.
Who is it?
Plumber.
Plumber? I didn't ask for a plumber. Who is it?
Telegram.
Oh, telegram. Just a moment.
Hello?
She opens the door, and then this ridiculous cartoon foam shark swallows her whole, and that's the bit. I could watch that 100 times and not get tired of it. So what do you say about that, Mark?
Well, I agree with you. And 101, I think. We feature it in the opening film in the exhibition. Visitors are taken into what looks like the elevator lobby at 30 Rock, as if they're going up to the ninth floor to see the show. And during that opening film, we play that clip. We play tribute to that first season. And then the doors open, the elevator doors, and you are walking towards home base, that home base you see there in three dimension in front of you. But this is a photograph, and before you know it, we've taken you back to 1975 and Monday, that day of the week when everything starts, and you'll see a full-scale replica of the first home base. And as you walk past that, there is the land shark, that goofy shark that you talked about. Now,
I didn't even know that. That's funny.
It's not the one that was there in 75. That is long since gone. In fact, one of the things you learn about the show, they never expected to be on the air for 43 years, let alone one season, let alone the first show even. So some of that stuff was gone forever, but it was so popular, that sketch, John, as you mentioned, it was redone for the 40th anniversary show by the same guy that built the foam shark back in 75, and there it is in the exhibition. So proud to have those sorts of pieces of history throughout this exhibit.
And yet you go from there to, say, another one of my favorite Saturday Night Live memories, if you will, was Dave Chappelle the night after the election, or the first live show after the election, doing what I thought was one of America's great monologues. And so you go from something that's inane and silly to something that's political and poignant and important. And what a range, what an ambition for a TV show to have. My understanding was that John Belushi eventually got a little tired of some of the silliness, the killer bees and things like that, that he wanted them to be more contemporary and cutting and not just silly. What do you remember or know about all of that?
I think that's true. I certainly sit at the feet of those historians that know SNL far better than I do. And by the way, we have the Killer Bee outfit in the exhibition as well. Some of our great comedic minds, our great comedic performers have come through Saturday Night Live. And they're different, right? They're some are silly and fun, and some are a little more complicated, like John was. And John had a very serious side, as we know. To your point, though, the Chappelle monologue, I agree with you. What a great piece of comedy and stand-up. I'm always amazed. You know, some of the monologues, you can tell performers that are actors or sports figures, you know, they're written for them, and they work with the writing staff to come up with an opening monologue. But when you see a true stand-up work it, like Chappelle did that night, the monologue usually goes much longer, and you really see that expression, that genius that so many of these stand-up comedians that have hosted Saturday Night Live have. The other thing to your point, John, real quickly, is even though silly sometimes, and we can look at Sarah Palin or Tina Fey as Sarah Palin, or Kate McKinnon as Hillary, or even our latest Donald Trump that we all know, of course, Alec Baldwin. It can be very silly, but it also is something that stimulates conversation the next day around the water cooler, I guess we still say. So it can be silly, it can be fun, it can be adolescent at times, but it usually politically, socially can point to something bigger that we're all talking about.
Mark Locke is the creative director of the exhibit SNL The Experience here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. We're on State Street in the 300 block in Chicago, just north of the river. Is Kedzie the cross street? Is that what you said a little while ago, Violetta?
Kinsey.
Don't go to Kedzie. That's a different street. Before I let you go, Mark, and by the way, Steve Bertrand just joining us here. Hi, Stevie. How are you?
Yay. Great.
One last question for our guest, and we'll all kind of kibitz a little bit about this, too, and that is, Mark, generally, what do you want people to make sure they see, or based on your experience putting this together, what stands out to you the most?
Well, you know, like any exhibition, and over the years I've had the privilege of doing a number of ones that have been seen by a few folks, people take away different things, but what I hear most about this from guests, when I kind of will stand into the corner and do a little questioning after they go through, it's usually this comment: I had no idea. Well, you know, we turn on at 11:30 on or 10:30 in Chicago on Saturday night. And, you know, it's like I said, it's a high wire act every week, sometimes better than the last or the last season better than the next. But it's always something that takes a risk. And when I think and have personally seen the thing come together from Monday and then that read through of the potential scripts, about 35 scripts read on Wednesday, and then Wednesday night those scripts are chosen, not all of them will make air, and then the sets start to be built on Thursday morning and rehearsals start and hair and makeup and wardrobe get busy. It really is incredible how it all comes together at this deadline when the show starts. And live from New York, it's Saturday night, is set over these many years. So I think people are most amazed by how it all comes together. It's a fun exhibit. I mean, you can plop yourself down on the Wayne's World set. It's not an exhibit that's behind glass, if you will. It's very participatory, got all the memories that you'd ever want, the things that you remember from the 70s all the way up to this season. So something I'm proud to be a part of. And I know people take different things from each experience, but it's mainly that, wow, this is amazing how this all comes together.
Mark Locke's the creative director of the exhibit, SNL The Experience, here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Mark, I want to visit with you in studio sometime the next time you're through Chicago. Make sure we sit down together, okay?
Be my pleasure. Great to be with you guys today. Enjoy the exhibition. Enjoy your day.
Yeah, we are at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Saturday Night Live, The Experience is here, and we're glad you are too. Steve just strolled into the studio. Hi, Steve Bertrand. How are you?
Hello, John Williams. I'm well. Thank you.
You hustled over after you did the noontime. What is the name of that show you do over there?
It's called the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Wintrust Business
Lunch. Thanks for never missing it.
Did you walk here?
Yeah.
Oh. Violetta took a cab.
What?
She took a cab.
I just wanted to be faster. Plus, I knew the traffic was good.
I'm not sure that a cab would be faster.
It really was. He saw me struggling. I stepped in some mud. He pulled over right away, and I jumped in.
Wow. So chivalry is not dead in Chicago. We'll pause and play back a couple more of our favorite clips from SNL on WGN. Is it a story you can share with us on the radio, Steve?
No.
Okay. Steve was just telling me something off the air, and then we had to jump on.
It involves nude modeling.
Hopefully not by you.
No.
Be sure to check out the CB app or hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays at 10 on WGN-TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. Speaking of Chicago's Best, I also want to mention a big thank you to Bang Bang Pie and Biscuits. Woo, 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 woo. Visit their bakeries in Logan Square or Ravenswood for sweet and savory pies and biscuits and coffee and more.
Okay, I can tell you.
Okay, but more importantly, so are we going to get some, is that pie free or do we have to pay for the pies that are here? Free. And does that include these people? Do they get to kind of mosey over and grab some? Thumbs up, everybody. Who's taking care of the studio audience? I am. And did I get the name right? Bang Bang Pie? Yeah. Okay, so your story is what?
Okay, so my son has wanted to take his car to college, and it's just a jalopy, right? And,
yeah.
And he won't get a job. He's never gotten a job at school. He gets straight A's, but I'm like, Noah, you got to get a job. And so finally in December or November, he was home for Thanksgiving. I said, all right, here's the deal. You get a job for the spring semester, and you can take your car.
You want him to have a job on campus?
Yeah, he does very well. He's very busy, but I just
want
him
to... Yeah, but then he gets a job, and the grades go right into the toilet.
They can suffer a little bit. He's doing fine. So he sends me an email yesterday or the day before. He's got a job.
All right.
What's he doing?
Well, it involves nude modeling for drawing classes.
He's going to be a nude model?
Or
he's going to draw nude models?
No, he would be the model.
Oh.
And so
I don't know. It would give me more disquiet. I don't know. It would be more concerning to me, my son drawing or my son posing.
So then he sends a text so I can take the car, right? So the boy wins. He totally outsmarted me.
Oh, wait a minute. He doesn't really have a job as a nude.
Oh, no, he does.
But he really does.
I think... So I probably should.
He's a good-looking guy, but wow!
Well, I think it's college. They just need anyway. I think his girlfriend is not going to let him do it, so the job is off. That's why I'm telling the story, because he's not going to do it.
Oh, we're not done talking about this. So
there's so many angles.
I know.
No, there's only one angle.
Really... Well, but you know, I suppose as a parent, I would be proud to know that my child was confident. You know,
What a great story! What a great story to have 20 years from now.
I know.
You know? And I want them to have my kids just so I can tell them.
Yeah, I think I'm going to use that story, and it didn't happen to me.
Right.
I'm just going to say it. I was a nude model.
Yeah, so I don't think it's going to happen because
I was working for gas money, and I had to take it all off.
Wow, would you feel the same way if your daughter was a nude model?
Probably not. That's not fair, but.
Well, I mean, I don't know what's fair about it, but it's that's a real thing. What would that pay?
Well, you know here's the, okay. So it was modeling for a drawing class, and it said,
"Sure,
would you be comfortable?" So it involved that. I think there wouldn't be all of that, but all of that would be involved at some time or another.
I don't know what you're talking about, but he would get paid money for it, right?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't do it for free, would you?
Some people would. I would
have
not.
You?
I can't imagine.
Have you?
Nobody's paying me to take my clothes off. I can promise you that.
Here's $5. Put the sweater on.
Exactly. I was a model where they said, please put more clothes on. Back to Saturday Night Live. We are at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago for the Saturday Night Live experience. We're on the fourth floor of this building at 360 North State Street in Chicago. If you haven't made this one of your to-do things in Chicago, you really should. It's really terrific. And so we're all sitting here recollecting some of our favorite Saturday Night Live memories. And I'll just offer for a moment part of Dave Chappelle's monologue after the election.
All my black friends who have money said the same thing when Trump got elected. That's it, bro. I'm out. I'm leaving the country. You coming with us? Nah, I'm good, dog. I'm going to stay here and get this tax break, see how it works out. Because that's how it is being Dave Chappelle. It's the first time I got some money, it didn't work out like that. The most unlikely thing that happened ever was a black president came out of nowhere like, come on, everybody, let's start thinking about everyone else. Oh, yeah, I just got this money! I didn't even think it was possible.
It's the best thing in the world when Dave Chappelle impersonates a white person. I go, oh, my God, that is us, isn't it? And that was just such a great and interesting night, I thought.
Here to comment further is Update Health Correspondent.
Dear Roseanne, Rosanna Dan.
Jane, you ignorant.
We're live from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. How am I doing? Does that sound like the guy on the...
Was it bad?
Pretty good. The Saturday Night Live experience is at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street in Chicago. Now, it's funny because that's very much a New York experience and scene, but if there was a second sister or city to the Saturday Night Live TV experience, it is Chicago.
Okay, so have you taken the tour of the Saturday Night Live studios?
In New York?
Yeah.
No.
I have twice.
Wow.
Oh, well, aren't you?
Not
just fancy. Once.
Yeah.
No, but my point is, it's so cool to see that. Remember, earlier I said, oh, the tongue stage?
Yeah.
Because it's because I've got the tour memorized.
Yeah,
so
no
it's
kidding.
Really cool to be here and to see. I mean, it's exactly the music set and the main stage.
Okay, so to
it's
our
so
right
cool.
is the, that's the tongue stage, the main stage,
well,
where they come out and do the monologue?
Well, the tongue stage then would come out from that, and
right.
that's where the host would come out and do the monologue a little bit.
But they tell me that not only does that look exactly like what I see on TV, but it is to scale. That's exactly the size of the stage, which is really small.
Yeah.
I want to see the guy with the clarinet sitting over there,
exactly.
who I always look at during the monologue because I just love him. His reactions are, you know, I kind of feed off of his reacting to the monologue.
Or think at the end of the show are there, you know, 15, 20 people
yeah,
on there.
Yeah, that's right. Think about how all of them are crashing on there. And then to its right and also to our right, is or it's to its left, is the Celebrity Jeopardy set,
right.
which is just one of my favorite skits from that show. I used to think they should do that every night, but I guess if you did something really good, you should give it some distance, not do it every single night. You
want to leave them wanting a little more, Johnny Boy.
Yeah, no kidding. Although we'll play a couple of other clips. Let's see, what did we schedule here? Well, this is, speaking of which, I think the one we said we'd feature in this half hour, we played a little bit of it a week ago, but we'll just play a tiny bit of it here. Elif, this would be the 135 bump, the SNL Celebrity Jeopardy final clip. Play that.
Let's just go to animal sounds for 600. This is the sound a doggy makes. Mr. Connery.
Moo.
No.
Well, that's the sound your mother made last night.
God, isn't that awful? Isn't that terrible? Isn't that wonderful? By the way, in our little studio audience that we have here, and we have a nice crowd of folks eating Bang Bang Pies. Woo, woo, woo. There's a young lady named Madison who is from Geneva. Now, Geneva from Madison. It's Madison from Geneva, who is a student at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, whence I hail, and a broadcast student there. Good to see that the program is still getting fine, bright young people into that program there. I just wanted to say this about Milt Rosenberg's passing. Steve, you and I worked for years with him at this radio station. He passed away yesterday. We all got the news listening to Steve Cochran this morning, or maybe you heard about it online or some other way. But he was a polymath.
Yeah, I didn't know that word until today.
I posted this on Facebook today. Milt Rosenberg, the longtime host of Extension 720 here on WGN Radio, passed away yesterday at the age of 92, and his friend Joseph Morris described him as a polymath. How perfect is that? Milt was always on an elevated plane, talking to guests, exploring concepts, using words that sounded interesting and important, even if they weren't readily accessible to most of us. Sometimes they were truly complicated topics. The role of Nietzsche, and he knew how to pronounce that, and what it plays in modern Western thinking. He did the mundane too, movie reviews and following the business of local broadcasting. A polymath, I looked it up, is a person whose expertise spans a number of different subject areas and will sometimes use that vast knowledge to solve a specific problem. That's a polymath. Milt never talked down to his audience or his guests. Better you meet him up there on that high radio perch. And if you didn't get it all or didn't care about the topic he was discussing, you could at least appreciate it for what it was. He was a maestro, seemingly always on the top of his game. Anything done that well is a thing of beauty. Around the station, he was a fairly solitary figure. He'd close the door to his office, classical music and piles of books greeting anyone who entered after first knocking. He was proud of WGN Radio and his show and fiercely protective of it. All the hosts and producers knew Milt's rule. About any hot author, Milt would have to be first. If you got in front of him with a publisher, you would likely hear later from the book's publicist. Could Milt have the guest first? We would always argue that an author of great enough stature on different days at different times would not overly saturate our airwaves and that he, Milt, could wait his turn. But Milt had to be exclusive or first, and if we resisted, the options were no one gets the interview or Milt would be first and exclusive anyway. Countless times I discussed this with him, his producers and book publishers, and Milt always won.
It's good to know you've gotten past that.
But don't worry about me, I'm fine. Milt never wanted to be away from his show either. He didn't use all of his vacation days. He wanted highlight shows run in his absence. When any of us did get to fill in for him, it felt really big, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It really did.
You would do his show once in a while. I did it a few times. There were 2 hours with minimal interruptions. The first hour was reserved for Milt and the guest, and the second hour he'd take calls. You could feel the IQs out there listening. And the distance from the regular host to the substitute host, when it was me anyway, seemed great indeed. And while Milt, he referred to himself as Milton, was old school in many ways, he was also ahead of his time. Today, I think we've recaptured the patient use of long-form spoken communication. Talk radio is vital. And podcasting is the new big thing, which is where Milt was all along. His show was formulaic, consistent, tempered, and curious enough to explore anything. It is cliche to say at times like this that we stand on the shoulders of those who came before us, but if this radio station, if WGN Radio stands for anything, it stands for honest, relevant, local, funny, and smart conversation. And with nods to other great radio legends who grace these microphones, it is also upon Dr. Rosenberg's thick black glasses that we stand. And from where I wish you a most cordial good night.
Hey, how about that? The thick black glasses are hip again, too.
That's now that you mentioned it.
Yeah.
They were all over the Oscars.
Maybe
the,
that's
the
where
Golden
Oprah
Globes
saw it first. It was on Milt.
Yeah. So thank you, Milt, for all that you did for all of us in Chicago.
You know, it's funny that we learn a new word on his death.
I know it.
No polymath.
His buddy goes polymath, and I go, well, here it's the Milt Rosenberg show all over again. It's extension 720.
I have distinct memories of filling because when you would fill in for Milt, the topics were already chosen.
I know.
For the most part,
what
and
did
the
you
guests
do?
Were. I had did one on pre-Columbian Mesoamerica, which apparently had to do with the Aztecs before Columbus got there. I still am not sure, and I did 2 hours on it.
I had to do quasars, black holes in the universe.
Right. I did a show on car dealerships and the future of car sales, and this was more than 20 years ago, and Jim Mattea was on and others talking about how one day people will buy cars online, you know, and here
which
we are.
Bizarre, yeah, let alone drive themselves. Milt was also kind of happy to ruffle feathers or mess things up. He, I think, purposely would say things on the radio sometimes that he knew darn good and well would not go down with the staff or the sponsors. And there were times where some of us had to do the cleaning up after Milt. You know, the next morning they'd say, did you hear what Milt said last night? And you go, oh, no. Now what? Well, he said this about X. Hey, could you help us out with that, John, and maybe give a little love the other way? And he knew that when, you know, he'd play this naive sort of you know, professorial guy who, oh, I didn't realize that that would be upsetting to somebody that I said that such and such wasn't so good. He was blatantly honest, and sometimes I think it got the better of him.
One other thing about, you know, he wanted the first interview on the radio station.
Oh, Lord.
It was bigger than that. He demanded the first interview in the city.
Yeah, that's right. He wanted it in the market.
Right.
You're right.
And so he would not talk to an author if they appeared on...
on another radio station.
Or TV station or anywhere like that.
And I'm like, who do you think
you are?
And
he had the power to do it.
And he was the guy. And
yeah.
In fact, they would acquiesce to him. They'd say, all right, well then... we won't put him on Channel 9 first. We'll put him on Milt first, and everybody else gets second.
So I was filling in the week that Bob Collins died in the year 2000. I was filling in for Milt Rosenberg. So I actually did Milt's show the night Bob died.
Oh, wow.
Which was a dramatic night. But in that week, the next night, I think, was for Milt's show, was the first time we went back to regular programming, so 24 hours later. And as I recall, it was that show. The guests were four musicians for the symphony orchestra. And one of the things I'll never forget about that interview, and this is what I mean, you learn so much about things on his show. These musicians, these world-accomplished musicians, each of them was lost in their life until they found their instrument. And... you know, that's not philosophy, that's not ancient civilization. These are artists who were floundering in their life, whether it's in school or in marriage or whatever, until they discovered not just music, but their instrument.
Hmm.
And it just set them and they went off for the rest of their life. That was the sort of stuff you pick up from his show.
From his show. And then we could spend some time talking about his relationship with Henry Kissinger. And how...
well, they dated.
They did not.
Oh, no, that wasn't it. No, was it then? Fred Scowcroft?
No. No, but I do remember one time some international crisis had erupted, and we're like, oh, you know, where everybody's scrambling. Oh, my God, we're at war with or not at war with X. What are we going to do? And who can give us some sort of interesting commentary on this international scene? And then they go, well... Henry Kissinger is in the other studio with Milt. And everyone's like, oh, my God, Henry Kissinger could talk about this. So then we all kind of tiptoe around the door waiting for Milt to finish a pre-taped interview he was doing with Henry Kissinger. And what happened next, I'll tell you in a minute. On WGN. We're broadcasting live from Saturday Night Live, The Experience at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And thanks again to Bang Bag Pie and Biscuits. They are in Logan Square and Ravenswood. Sweet, savory pies, biscuits, coffee, and more. Is that key lime pie and the cherry pie and stuff good?
You know,
everyone's busy eating.
Yeah, no
they
kidding.
Can't answer.
This year for Christmas, I bought 10 of those calendars. And put my name on it and then gave it to people.
That's not right.
So they would think of me all year long.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one way to do it, Steve. I hadn't thought
idea.
About it
yeah.
that way.
Sometimes. Along with scratching out the days, they're also scratching out your name.
By the way, Mark's on the phone and wanted to say something. We were just talking before the break. I'll finish my story in a second about Milt Rosenberg, the longtime Extension 720 host. He was on this radio station for...
almost 40 years.
40 years. Mark, you're on GN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Yeah, I have two comments. First of all, I wish we could still hear Gene Phillips, the movie reviewer and priest. He was on Milt's show many times, and I loved his movie reviews. I don't know if he's still alive.
I don't know. He had a regular cast of book reviewers and movie reviewers. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. The other comment I have is that anyone can be a lifelong learner who really wants to be. And Milt's show helped me to be that. And his compliments to listeners could be very generous. And in my case, they actually implied a tribute to his show. Several times he thought I was a Bible professor, and I am not. He thought I was a music teacher or performer, and I'm neither. But apparently my comments during his shows led him to think that. And what he may not have realized was that his show was a part of my being able to come across that way. Without shows like his, you know, I mean, any listener can read books, any listener can get into good group discussions, but Milt's show was incomparable in that he, there was a little bit of elitist in him, but at the same time, as I say, he was very generous in complimenting his listeners and, you know, paying tribute to what they could offer.
How many times did you talk to him on the air?
I lost count, but... That, and
well, that's playing on the varsity team if you're on Milt's show.
I bring it up because I forgot until you brought this up.
He didn't mind repeaters.
Well, he wouldn't have known your name. That was the other thing.
He never referred
to the callers
right.
by name.
He said, hello, caller,
you're on the air.
I know. And I'm like, really, Milt? Yeah. Would it kill you to give the person's name? But for some reason, Milt had Milt's way.
Yeah.
Mark, thanks for the phone call. I'm glad you were able to join us and join us on Milt Rosenberg's show, too. So that happy young man over there in the ball cap, he looks like Bluto from Popeye or a Robin Williams character, maybe. That muscular man in the black T-shirt and the tattoos and the hat. Is Christian Piccolini, and his book is White American Youth. This is the book and the author I was telling you about a little while ago. At 2 o'clock in the morning, this morning, I'm still lying in bed reading his book. I missed my L stop getting off because I was finishing it today. And it is going to be with me for a very long time, what this man lived and experienced and does now. You may have seen him on 60 Minutes just before Christmas. He's going to join us after the news here on WGN.
From River North, it's John Williams live on 720 WGN. Live from Saturday Night Live, the national exhibit at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Now welcome, John Williams.
Hey, listen to that unprompted, spontaneous burst of applause. I'm John. We are sitting at the Weekend Update desk. Isn't this cool? Violetta Podromedic, Steve Bertrand, and I, along with Elif Garris, our producer. Ernie, our engineer, is here, members of the WGN Radio family, and our guests. And behind us it says Weekend Update, Weekend Update, Weekend Update across a world map in blue with the countries in different colors. It's kind of cool.
That's what that is.
Yeah, well, this is my favorite part, obviously, of the show.
You know, really?
I'll stay up to watch Weekend Update every week.
I think it's vacillated, the show and that component of it, in its relevance over the years. But I would say what they say on Saturday nights now is almost must-see TV. I mean, it'll appear on Sunday morning or on Monday news shows.
Right.
What they said on that comedy show Saturday nights.
Don't forget your story.
So we just talked a little while ago about the passing of Milt Rosenberg, who was our longtime Extension 720 host here on WGN Radio. And Cochran started it this morning, telling some stories about how interested Milt was in the buzz at the station all of the time. And I just said, well, for me, too, one of the things I remember most was how fierce he was about getting his show right, about getting his guests, about fighting for his turf, like he wants his guests first, etc. And when this one international crisis, I don't remember what it was, you know, we didn't go to war as it turns out, but we thought, wouldn't it be great to have somebody who could comment on this international political story? And sitting there recording in the studio next to us is Henry freaking Kissinger with Milt Rosenberg. But again, knowing that Milt, you know, certainly wanted the exclusive on Henry, they counted themselves as friends. When Henry was in town, he would reach out to Milt. So, you know, you sort of wanted to protect their space. When they got done, there was like a gaggle of people waiting there, and we said, Milt, we want Dr. Kissinger to jump on with Spike Odell and talk about international relations or something like that. And I don't think we handled it well. You know,
And had he done it, then that would have violated Milt's rule of...
I know, because Milt had him, and Milt was going to, you know, try and get Dr. Kissinger on his show that night or some night very soon.
Didn't matter. Could have been weeks from now.
It kind of could have been. But, you know, and Milt won. We did not steal Dr. Kissinger from him. It probably was just as well. I don't know how any of us would have been able to handle Henry Kissinger in a live, free-flowing interview like that anyway. But I guess it's just my way of remembering how Milt wanted to do the best possible show every night, and he was ever vigilant about that, you know? So, speaking of doing something really well, isn't this a friendly-looking guy? Look at this sweet, smiling face of this gentleman sitting next to me.
Thank you.
don't look at all the tattoos, though. Christian Piccolini is here. He is the author of a book called White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. I was in bed at 2 o'clock this morning, almost finishing. Later, I did on the train this morning your book. And it is about you growing up in the Blue Island, Beverly area of Chicago, and falling into the white supremacist movement, right?
Yeah, the earliest iteration of the American white supremacist skinhead movement was actually born in Blue Island on the southwest side of Chicago, roughly in the mid-80s. I was recruited at 14 years old in 1987, and I spent 8 years of my life as a part of that movement.
8 years.
8 years.
It's funny because you lived so much life in those 8 years. It's worth remembering that when you get out, you're still 21, 22 years old.
Right.
You got a lot of life ahead of you, but by the same token, you think this guy's life is over. He should either be in jail or dead or so tainted that he'll never be able to recover a productive life and a positive attitude. And yet you have done that. It's interesting to me, too, because in the first chapter or two of your book, if you ever wondered, how is it that somebody could fall into that sort of stupid, hateful notion that Jews, gays, and people of color are the source of your problems? That's the white supremacist movement. How does that happen? Read the first chapter of this guy's book, and you'll get it instantly.
Yeah, I mean, for all intent and purpose, I was a normal kid from a normal family that should have led a normal life. But like Steve said, I hadn't found my guitar yet.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Yeah.
And I have an interesting Milt story, too, that I can share later. But
you have a Milt Rosenberg story?
I was invited on the Milt show, and there was a fill-in, and I was bummed about that because somebody
was it me or Steve?
Yeah, I don't remember who it was.
Right.
But at one point in the GN studio, somebody had come up to the windows and started taking their clothes off from outside from Michigan Avenue.
Oh, that was John.
It may have been John at that point. So that was a really interesting story. I never got to meet Milt, but I did get booked for his show.
Well, there was a time, too, where the white supremacist movement via Chicago was really exploding on the national scene. Oprah Winfrey did a show. Geraldo Rivera did the one, remember, where they threw the chair onto the stage and broke Geraldo's nose. You were in the studio audience for that show?
I was not. I was watching as a young 14-year-old boy both the Oprah show and the Geraldo Rivera show, totally entranced by what I had just become a part of and thinking it was the coolest, angriest thing I could possibly get.
Yeah, but all of us saw that and saw, oh, boy, that'll teach those angry monster wannabes, and yet you were enchanted. You were all in.
Yeah, you know, I'd spent, even though I did come from a great family, I'd spent, you know, first 14 years of my life bullied, marginalized, feeling very, disenchanted.
Your family were immigrant Italians who dressed differently, spoke differently, acted differently. You got picked on as a result.
Yeah, I mean, my parents are Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and they were often the victims of prejudice. So it wasn't a part of my family DNA. I wasn't raised as a racist. It was quite the opposite. But I was, just like every young person, looking for an identity, a community, and a purpose. And I wasn't able to find that. I wasn't able to find my guitar.
It almost sounds like you were rebelling against who you were. I mean, you got angry at people who were like you.
I was angry at my parents because I felt abandoned by them because they were working 7 days a week, 14 hours a day.
To try and provide an education for you, sir. I was really getting mad at you reading your book.
I'm sure you were. I get mad thinking about it now that I didn't quite understand that they were just doing what they had to do to survive as immigrants, having to work harder. But as a kid, you don't know that. You just don't.
So you feel neglected. And then there's a moment, though, where everybody in the, I guess, south side, the south suburbs, we were talking Blue Island and Beverly at the time?
Blue Island, Beverly, Alsip area.
Alsip. And everybody knew about this one guy
Yeah. And that one guy is the man who recruited me. His name was Clark Martel.
He pulls up in a Camaro or a fancy car. And instead of... I'll tell you a story. I'm really good at it.
Go for it.
And
it's fresh. You just read the book.
Well, I know. but instead of him saying, hey, pick a weenie, instead of making fun of you, either your height, your ethnicity, or whatever it was that was bothering you as a little kid those days, he said, oh, you're Italian. Oh, you should be proud of that. And there you were, standing there getting high with one of your buddies. He knocked the marijuana, the joint out of your mouth or hands and said, why are you doing that? That's bad for you. You can't become the person that you should be if you're getting stoned all of the time. And by the way, look up your people. Italians are great people. They are great warrior people. They are great men, and that's you. And light goes on.
And yeah, he pulled me in with this idea of pride. But then he would follow that up with that thing you're so proud of, that thing that your generations have worked hard for. There are people who want to take that away from you. And when he pulled that joint out of my mouth, John, he specifically said to me, and I'll never forget this, that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile. I didn't know at 14 what the heck a communist, except for, you know, the Russian guy in my favorite Rocky movie. I don't think I had met a Jewish person, and I probably wouldn't have known if I had at that age. And I didn't even know what the word docile meant.
Well, did there come a moment?
It's true.
Did there come a moment, though, where you thought, okay, I'm in, that while that might have seemed fascinating to you or intriguing, you're going to be a vile-spewing, punching, partying thing.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Happened very quickly, because to stay a part of this new community, because I'd gone from powerless to feeling this perceived power, and to stay a part of that, I had to do the things that kept me a part of it, and that was violence, that was spreading the rhetoric, that was then learning how to recruit other young people by focusing on their vulnerabilities and then promising them paradise. And if that sounds familiar, that's because that's what every extremist group does, is they key in on the vulnerabilities of the most marginalized, they promise them paradise, they blame their problems on the invisible other, and then they draw them in through the sense of pride that they're changing the world, but it flips. It turns into violence, and it turns into destruction.
Can you tell he does TED Talks? Christian Piccolini is here. White American Youth is his book. He's a Chicagoan. He lives a short walk from where we're sitting right now, and he has now been telling his story, counseling families, trying to save kids from what you went through.
I've spent the last 15 years of my life trying to help pull people from the same movements that I helped build, and I've helped over 100 people, I think, disengage.
The amount of I have never read a more personal description of violence than I read in your book. I mean, so you were beating people up. You were getting beat up. You were a star athlete in high school.
Eisenhower. I went to 6 high schools.
Yeah, right.
Kicked out of all of them.
No
one
kidding.
Of them twice.
You got kicked out of alternative high schools, the kind where they just said, show up and you'll get a diploma. You got kicked out of that stuff.
And here I am at the Weekend Update.
I know you don't need me to remind you of all of this, but it's pretty amazing that a person as high IQ as you are and were. I mean, if you ever did deign to go to a class, you'd ace the test. You were high, and a talented person, an athlete. I mean, a good-looking, athletic, smart person should have had the time of his life when he was 16, 17 years old.
I wish you would have told me that at 15, 16
years old. Yeah, but your parents were trying, and the coaches were trying. Other people were trying. What, I guess this is the question for people out there who are worried about their kids the way yours were you. What could they have said or done to save you then?
You know, I think by the time I was so entrenched, and that was not that long after 14, maybe 16 years old, people saw me as a lost cause. They saw me as a monster. And the truth was, is I wasn't born that way. I was a broken human being, and while on my search to belong, was willing to do monstrous things to stay a part of that. And I think that we forget that when we see these people marching with torches and you know, saying these things, is that while, you know, I don't have necessarily sympathy for the things that they're saying or doing, I understand that at some point they went from a normal human being who had issues that they couldn't solve into this movement where now they're being seen as monsters. And I can't look at them as monsters, because then I'd have to look at myself as a monster.
Okay.
And that's what allows me to help them.
That allows you to help them. But I still don't know that I know what does that parent say or do. Do they nurture that kid, or do they give him a swift kick in the ass?
I think we have to. I think we're failing our young people, the ones that are the most vulnerable. We need to identify the passions of our young people and then bolster them. We need to listen more than we speak to young people. While they don't have all the answers, right? We can be good guides, but we need to empower them and be accountable for their own lives. If somebody had come up to me in that alley at 14 years old and said, "Hey, you know, you're a good ball player, you're a good artist, why don't you come with me?" And if Clark Martel was standing right next to me, I would have gone with the coach. I wouldn't have gone with the skinhead. And there just wasn't that opportunity for me. People had written me off.
So when you see the parades in Charlottesville, you don't see lost causes? You don't think anyone there is a lost cause?
No, I don't. I don't, because I have seen, myself included in this, people who have done the worst things that are imaginable and go to prison and find a way to seek forgiveness for what they've done and come out some of the most amazing human beings.
Do you seem eminently forgivable given what you've done in the past 10 or 15 years? Do you run into people who don't forgive you?
Oh, sure. Sure.
How do you
forgive you?
Sure.
Yeah. I believe they don't.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are absolutely people that don't know me, I mean, that don't know the work that I've done, that are easy and quick to judge. But I still, you know, I know that I have to work the rest of my life to make amends. I haven't ever solved the problem of what I put into this world.
Well, what did you think when you watched Charlottesville on TV unfold? What was your reaction to that?
You know, I was terribly saddened by what happened, but I wasn't surprised, because rallies like Charlottesville happen almost every weekend in cities all across.
Do you think the country is going up or down, or where are we on the white supremacist roller coaster?
I think a lot of young people are getting sucked into this movement as a social movement, not knowing exactly what they're getting involved in, because they've done, and we started this 30 years ago, we started the process of normalizing the extremism. We recognize that the shaved heads, the tattoos, the swastika flags were turning away the average American white racist that we needed to recruit. So we said, ditch the shaved heads, grow the hair out,
right,
trade in the boots for suits, go to college campuses and recruit, get jobs in law enforcement, go to the military and get training. And 30 years have gone by since we started that process, and here we are. We're calling it the alt-right. We're calling it white nationalism, which, by the way, are words that they sat around a table one day and said, what can we call ourselves to make us seem less hateful? So those are their terms. I refuse to call them by those terms. They're white supremacists. I understand their outward-facing marketing, and I understand what they do.
What's in it for the recruiting? Why did that guy Clark stop to recruit you? I mean, it's not like it's a Democrat or Republican trying to get votes at the ballot box. Why do they want the numbers?
Power, ego. I mean, these movements are run by, you know, very egotistical, selfish people who use other people as pawns. That's the only way that you can prey on other people to do your bidding, is if you can.
Yeah, but it sounded like, I mean, throughout the book, it's like, okay, we need to save the white race. We need, the 14 words include the notion that we need to save America for our kids. So if you're a white person, you want to have a country where your kids will be able to have a good life, and the people of color, the Jews and the queers, are taking it from us, right?
The truth is I never knew or had a meaningful interaction with anybody that I thought I hated. I hated people because I hated myself, and I was projecting my own self-hatred onto other people because I didn't want to feel that pain myself.
We need to pause. It's 2:23. Kristen Piccolini is here. His book is White American Youth. You know, this isn't fiction, and it's not 100 years ago, and it's not on Mars. It's in Chicago. It's the 1970s and 80s we're looking at mostly here.
80s and 90s.
80s and 90s. And he's with us at the Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Saturday Night Live, The Experience set. More about that when we visit with the former Saturday Night Live star. But we'll finish this conversation with Kristen in a minute here on WGN. John Williams here. We're at the Museum of Broadcast Communications for the Saturday Night Live, The Experience exhibit. You need to make this on your stop of things to do when you come to Chicago, or as you are in Chicago. Have you been here yet? Julia Sweeney, you remember her as Pat, among other things, on Saturday Night Live, is here, and she'll tell her story and talk a little bit about that whole SNL experience as well. By the way, Amita Health knows you like no one else. They're the one that's there for you always. Lifelong bonds that make all the difference. The one that knows what you need and when you need it, that's Amita Health. They put you first. Amita Health includes 9 hospitals, 7 immediate care centers, 78 outpatient locations in the northwest and southwest suburbs. Visit AmitaHealth.org/YOU or call 855-MY-AMITA in sickness and in health. Ernie, I want to make sure I understand your question. My engineer Ernie said, how does he feel about, or how do the old skinheads feel about him today, right? I mean, so visiting with us for just a few more minutes is Christian Picciolini, the Chicagoan whose White American Youth book you should read. It talks about what that white American white supremacist movement was and is like. He's out of it. He's helping families get out of it. What does the old gang say about you now?
Oh, I get death threats on a regular basis. I get my address published. And, you know, many of them have actually contacted me for help. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of how I affect these people with my story.
How is it when they come to you for help? They're trying to get help getting out, but there must be some secrecy involved as well.
Well, sure, they're scared. I mean, sometimes they live normal lives, and if they come out, you know, they could lose their job, they could lose their family. Sometimes their loved ones don't know. And, you know, they've given up the ideology, or at least they're questioning it. And the way, you know, that I pull them out is very slowly, and I listen, and I try and fill in whatever potholes existed in their life.
But you make it sound like alcoholics who first have to want to get out themselves. I mean, you're not, if they're coming to you, they've probably already made the first, most important step.
Right, usually, but sometimes I have what I call a bystander. It could be a family member or a loved one.
Who said, rescue my kid.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, they don't always want to get out, and I've had many successful cases like that as well.
250 pages in your book, the last 40 of which are you getting out or so. And I've only got a minute or so left, but what do you want to say about how you turned your own tide?
You know, it's really simple. It was a very complicated process, but the solution was simple. I received compassion from the people that I least deserved it from when I least deserved it. And that was the most transformative thing for me.
Did you think commerce was part of what saved you? That is, because in order to help make ends meet, I mean, he was eminently unemployable and underemployed. Yeah. And so he decides, fine, I'll open up my own record shop. So he opens up a record shop. What was the name of your record shop?
It was called Chaos
Records. Chaos Records, good name. Yeah. So he does that, and he's selling all of this alternative music. Some of it is hate-filled, but some of it crosses borders and barriers so that gays and Jews and people of color are also coming in and buying some of this music they can't get elsewhere. And you go, hey, these people are giving me money.
The money's all green.
That's not so, I know.
That's how it started.
It's very liberating, wasn't that?
Yeah, I had no problem at that point taking money from what I thought was the enemy. But what I realized over time was that as they came in, they kept showing me this compassion and having empathy for me, even despite knowing how terrible I was. And they kept trying to build a relationship with me. And I realized eventually that I had more in common with them than I did the people that I had surrounded myself with in this movement. And I had started to humanize them because I was just demonizing them. I'd never met them. I'd never had meaningful interactions with the people I thought I hated. And then suddenly, the prejudice disappeared because I was able to humanize them, and the rest is kind of
interesting. Say that again. You were shown compassion by people. You said that
I least deserved it from when I least deserved it. I was at my worst, and these people were the people I was hurting, and suddenly they were the ones who said, you know what, I see something inside of you that you don't even see yourself.
So are you religious now? Because that sounded very Judeo-Christian. That sounded very...
I was raised a Catholic,
and hated every minute of it in school.
Yeah, I hated every minute of it. Because of the rules and the subservience I felt in it. But I am a spiritual person, and I believe, you know, if you were to ask me about God or religion, I think that our connection to each other is really that God, how we treat each other.
We're out of time, but I wish you nothing but success. I want the movie rights to the story. Although if you read, you remember American History X with Edward Norton? Did you see that movie? It's really hard to watch. It's fantastic. And your story is a lot like what I saw or remembered there, although yours is also different because you're a different person, you're a real person, and every page in this book is a scene in a movie that I think would be important to watch. So are the movie rights available?
The movie rights are available. I think we're going to have a small discussion after this to try and tell
you. Yeah. Not small, short.
It'll be a short discussion. Well, I have a friend, Lou Manfredini. He has a lot of money, so we'll get Lou in on this. Lou's always got big ideas, so we'll
get... build a set, too.
Exactly. Hey, listen, put it there. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, John.
Christian Picciolini, White American Youth. My descent into America's most violent hate movement and how I got it.
First of all, I need some protection.
Oh, dear God. Okay, all right.
I'm under armed witness. I'm never one to offend. And I need some feminine napkins.
Oh, I'm in hell now.
You never know when Aunt Wilma's going to stop by for lunch.
What a bizarre character. This is John Williams, and we are at the Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Saturday Night Live exhibit. Do come and see this. And also, thanks to the whole staff that's been here. Violetta Podromedics, get ready to run back to the Rokan Show. Steve Bertrand is here from WGN Radio News. I'm John Williams. Ernie's our engineer, and there is my producer, Elif Garris. You know Elif, among other things, not just as my producer, but as also as the voice of Siri on the John Williams Show.
Hi, John. How are you?
Exactly. So, also in our studio is Julia Sweeney. You know her as Pat. We just heard a clip from that from Saturday Night Live. Julia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're not in New York. This is the real Saturday Night Live set, but obviously there's the Celebrity Jeopardy set, which was actually used on the show over there, and the front stage.
Yeah. No, it's great.
We're on the original Saturday Night Live Weekend Update set, or actually the one they used, I think, for the 40th anniversary show, but this was used on the show. Is this a little deja vu-y for
you? It is.
And when you think back on your Saturday Night Live experience, what comes first and foremost to mind?
Just how exciting, I mean, it sounds so trite, but just how exciting it was on Saturday. Like, I love big efforts with lots of people all concentrating together, and when it all was coming together on Saturday, usually I got there about 1 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and just like every hour at the building and the building of the building until the show was on, and then it was such a head rush, and then the party. That's probably what comes to mind.
So you guys would do a dress rehearsal in the evening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then change things an hour before?
Yeah.
Tell me about how all of that went.
Well, it was really stressful. And it was really...
In front of an audience.
Yeah, you did I think it was at 7 o'clock. Or maybe it was 8? I can't remember. Anyway, it was a show. You know, we did the entire show, and it was long. So it was really, sometimes it went like 2 hours long. And then you'd do the show, and then everyone would go up to Lauren's office in the 8th floor, because he had 2 different offices. So we went in that, and he sat on the floor, and there was a big grease board, and he started writing the show, and you would see if your sketch was cut or not. And people were writing stuff down and figuring out how they were getting from this sketch to the other.
And was that based all on audience reaction, or the way he saw it when he saw it done?
Yeah, and also the host had input, and...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there was a bunch of factors, but it was his call in the end.
The gentleman that's the curator of this exhibit said he followed the show for a week or two, or maybe even longer, and he said that it was amazing to him, that there would sometimes be 30 or 35 sketches, pieces that were ready for broadcast.
Yeah.
And you did not know what was going to make the cut, maybe until that day.
Yeah, and sometimes during the show, if something went long or got more laughs than you expected it to get, so it went on longer, your sketch could be cut. You could be walking. I've many times when I was walking onto the set and they would say, stop, the sketch has been cut.
You still get paid, though, right, for that?
Well, you just get a salary. It doesn't really matter.
But it explains the cue cards and why you're always reading.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
right.
also, like, sometimes you'd have writers come up to you and say, I've changed all your lines in this sketch. Oh, go. Just be sure to look at the cue cards.
Well, I suppose every person who's created an iconic Saturday Night character gets asked about it for the rest of their lives, right?
I guess that's true.
So this is that part of the interview.
You're not there yet.
How did you create Pat the androgynous character whose gender we were never clear about?
Yes. Well, you know, it's so funny because I've been thinking about it a lot because I'm going to talk about it in my new show. And it was really an afterthought, the androgyny part of it. It was really that I was working for a guy that was so irritating to me in these ways that I incorporated in Pat.
Is he here today, by the way?
No.
Is that no?
And he stood too close to me. He had really bad distance from people, and he was drooling a lot. His eyes were watering, and he had a lot of nasal issues, and he was always saying, like, do you want to have lunch tomorrow? And I'd say, oh, I can't. Because I used to work as an accountant. You have to understand that.
This is in your accounting days.
In my accounting days.
Right.
And I'd say, no, I can't. And he'd go, what about tomorrow? And I'd go, well, no. Like, he wouldn't... There was no way he'd take...
No,
he wouldn't get it. And so he drove me so crazy, and I tried to do him. I was doing him for my friends at the Groundlink Theater. That's where I came out of in L.A. And then I tried to do it at first as a guy, but I really wasn't good enough. It didn't come off. And then I thought, and it was really like an afterthought. I thought, you know what, I'll just make it that we don't know if it's a man or woman because I can't really convincingly be a guy, but it's sort of not a woman either. And then when I started doing it, that was the thing that people really responded to.
Was, right, because the character might say something, you go, oh, that's a tell, this is
right.
a guy. But then she,
right.
at the last second, make it appear as though that could have been a man or a woman. That
yeah.
would say, I need lubricant. Oh, that's maybe a guy. But then it would be for my eyes, because
right.
I have scratchy eyes or
right.
something like
yeah.
that.
So,
would yeah. you mind giving us a little of Pat just now?
God, I haven't done it in so long. Pat sort of talk like this. Like that. I guess I just sort of lowered my voice and
well,
had a weird laugh.
God, there's a guy out there right now going, oh, crap, that's me.
Well, I had, you know, it was an interesting experience because I had a lot of people write me. The thing is, the guy that I was imitating, obviously I'm making fun of him. But I wasn't really making fun of, you know, androgynous people who I actually like. You know, like, and I'm glad for them. But then I would start getting letters from people who were, like, intersex or androgynous who really loved Pat. And I'd think, oh, you shouldn't love Pat. Because Pat is a really horrible person.
No, Pat wasn't a horrible... I guess you're the older
well,
judge
not
of this.
A horrible person.
I didn't see Pat as a horrible person. It's kind of a pathetic person.
If I knew that Pat was going to be so popular, I wouldn't have made Pat more likable.
You would or would not
I
have?
I would have.
Would have made Pat more
yeah.
likable.
So, you know, you can find anyone now, right? Do you know where the inspiration is? Do you know where the guy is?
I do.
Is he close? Is he in the room?
No.
Did you marry him?
Yeah, I travel around with him. Yes, that's right. He's my husband.
Actually, I thought it might have been John.
I finally
but
should go
John.
To lunch.
So it's not John.
Go ahead.
So where... So, I mean...
I actually run into him occasionally. And he has no idea.
Closer, yeah.
No, he has no idea. He doesn't look anything like Pat or anything.
Would you ever tell
and
him?
And actually, he's not that gross anymore. He, you know, this is a long time ago. We both became other different people. But he is a little odd, but not that odd. I, of course, exaggerated.
Are you ever tempted to tell him?
No. In fact, I'm so in fear of him finding out. Because I think he would be so upset. And he's not androgynous at all. He's a very much a guy. I mean, like, and I think he would take it like I was, I don't know. I don't think it would be good.
But what year did you do Pat on SNL?
90 to 94.
So I wonder where we were in the whole transgender, LGBTQ, androgynous.
It was really early.
You were ahead of the game.
Well, was I? I mean, like, or behind the game. I don't know. Yeah, I think it was...
I mean, I wonder if you did it today, would you do it for these reasons?
Well, I think I would do it, but I wouldn't make Pat obnoxious.
Yeah. Well, so you do that. And then when you leave Saturday Night Live, you know how sometimes a skit gets made into a movie? That thing became a movie. Were you surprised at that thing? I know you wrote the movie, but were you surprised that you were able to get that movie off the ground and get it produced?
I guess so. Yeah, I was surprised. That was a whole other experience. It was exciting and fun. It had a lot of problems on the set. We went through directors. There was a lot of issues with it, and then it ended up being a big bomb, which was a whole other experience.
Well,
Hollywood.
So we'll sprint to the finish here. So that comes and goes in your life, and then you run into a series of tragedies. You lose.
Yes, actually, I had the biggest bomb. In fact, Pat was such a big bomb that Entertainment Weekly had a Pat, like, on the cover of Entertainment Weekly with over it, biggest bomb of the year. Like, just, and then that same week, my brother was diagnosed with cancer, really late stage cancer, and then I got cancer. So, that was not a good year.
So then, fast forward a little longer, you've
yeah.
lost your brother, you survived,
yeah.
and you do a show called God Said Ha.
Yes.
And that went well for you.
Yeah, that went really well. And actually...
You were nominated for the Grammy of
yes.
the CD of that.
Yeah.
Among other things.
Yes. Yeah, that was good. And I was on Broadway with it. I did it on Broadway.
And it was it your
yeah.
story to that point?
Yeah. And actually, my parents were living with me for almost a year while my brother was ill, and then I was ill. And every Sunday night, I went to this little club in L.A. At Luna Park, which is that no longer exists, but there was this thing there called the Uncabaret. It was sort of like the beginning of the alternative comedy, you know, like where you could just tell stories instead of jokes. So just as a release, every Sunday night, I went and was with a whole group of other comics. And I just got up and talked for 15 minutes about what happened to me that week. And it was a tiny room that could only have 50 people in the room. But I did that the whole year. And the guy who was running it recorded it all, which I didn't even know he was recording it. And then at the end, once I was, you know, cured of my cancer and I was trying to get back into work, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And he said, oh, I have all these tapes. You really should put all this together. And it was so great that he taped it because I forgot all these stories. Because I was just telling the stories like you would at a dinner party, and I forgot about it. So I shaped that into God Said Ha, and then I ended up doing that for several years.
And then two follow-up shows to that. Now she's in Chicago doing Older and Wider. I'm reading from the card here.
Yes.
Saturday Night Live veteran, 1990 to 1995, author, actor, and TED Talk maestro Julia Sweeney makes her Second City stand-up debut, and that's this Friday night, I believe.
Yes,
right?
But it's a workshop. I'm working towards the show being a show.
Oh, hush, hush, hush.
Okay.
So
they keep saying it's a show. It's like, no. It's like the ingredients
I
for
pay
a show.
Money, you stand up and talk, right?
And this will
Where
be
I
like...
come from, that's a show.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so that's what it is. More about that in a minute here on WGN. And I want to just give one more quick plug here to Julia Sweeney, who you remember as Pat, or perhaps you saw her in God Said Ha, her show that started in San Francisco and finished on Broadway.
Wow.
And now she's in a workshop.
You must have read my Wikipedia page.
I did. And I read your, and because I do thorough research, I read your IMDb page, too.
It doesn't stop with Wikipedia with you. You go on to IMDb.
I'm about to read her IMDb page.
D.B.
Julia Sweeney, benevolent, sweet-faced actress and comedian.
I want to be like badass, cool girl. But I'm the way I am.
I got bad news for you.
I know I am. That's like, I didn't control that. That's I came out.
I don't think the world is worse off for having benevolent, sweet-faced people. Do we need more badass people, Julia? Seriously?
Well, you know what? Because it's like if people have, you know, they would say like resting face, a mean face.
RBF, yeah.
Yes. You know, they can't control that.
Well,
well it's
face.
The same with me.
Let's
people
see your face.
Think I'm really I am really friendly.
Rest. No, that's... Let me see a resting face.
So it's totally resting?
Yeah. Yeah. She's a delightful. It's a benevolent,
like,
and sweet.
But it's good and bad. That's all I'm saying.
Her show is in workshop right now.
It's in workshop.
It's in workshop.
I want to see how the sausage is made.
How do I do that? Go to Second City?
Go to Second City, and it's going to be in a small theater. It's only 56 seats.
If you think she's delightful here, I can imagine she will be there, too. If not, ask for your money back.
And then you'll hear me ramble on as I put together a new show.
SecondCity.com. 337-3992 in Chicago on North Avenue. What a pleasure to meet you. We'll
Thank
come
you
out
so
and
much.
See your show. Visit with us again before you take this one to Broadway, too, all right?
Oh, you're so sweet.
Nice to meet you. Julia
nice
Sweeney,
to meet you.
Folks.
Thank
How about
you so
that?
Much.